a mean field BCS-like Hamiltonian on a lattice for the case where the pairing, the terms that will give rise to the Cooper pairs, correspond to creating and destroying electrons on nearest neighbor sites. And that's this delta here is, you know, in the square lattice, x minus x, y minus y. And to some extent, I should say that I introduced the extended Hubbard model and then also the TJ model just to give you an idea of what kinds of Hamiltonians could give rise to this extended pairing. In other words, pairing which is not just two electrons on a site, but two electrons on nearest neighbor sites in this lattice picture. And then it's true that the TJ model itself, everyone could see, the TJ model arising as it does from the on-site Hubbard model is basically part of a solution to a strong correlation problem, and hence more complicated. Nevertheless, you know, when viewed as just a simple Hamiltonian, you could see how, with attractive nearest neighbor interactions, that this you could give rise to something where this would be the mean field Hamiltonian. Okay, and so I just want to talk about this for a minute without reference to where it comes from. Okay, so right away we want a Fourier transform. I don't think I got that far yesterday, right? So right away we want a Fourier transform. So this is sum over k and alpha epsilon of k minus mu c dagger k alpha c k alpha. And then from these pairing terms, you have plus a half sum over k. How do we do it? It should look like this. Sum over delta and then the other term, which is just the complex conjugate. And we'll call this, so I say I didn't leave myself a lot of room here, but we'll call this delta of k, and we'll call this delta of k star. And I think when we originally did our BCS theory, we allowed for the possibility that these deltas might depend on k, and then we got rid of it. So what are these things? Well, right away, this epsilon k for the square lattice and we've looked at that before. And delta of k is just equal to delta sub x. Why do I have this? Oh, I see. Sorry. In my notes, and actually it's not hard for you to change once, in my notes I had it this way. So why don't we do that just so that we're consistent with my notes. Delta x, it won't make any difference at all. Kx plus delta of y e to the minus iky. Where these are the x and y components of k plus delta of minus x e to the ikx plus delta of minus y e to the iky. So the actual shape of the gap function will be determined by these four constants. And let me just throw out two possibilities which are consistent with the fact that we're on a square lattice. So one is delta x equal delta minus x equals delta y equals delta minus y. And so what do you get? So this corresponds to what is called extended S wave. The gap function delta S of k is equal to 2 delta S naught times cos kx plus cos ky. And this has the same symmetry as on-site pairing. Okay, and in fact, if there is any attractive interaction, I mean, actually probably whether or not, but certainly if there is an attractive interaction for two electrons being on the same site, that will mix together with this, and you'll get your gap function will include some pairing on the site. In fact, I think even if it's repulsive, you'll still get some non-zero pairing amplitude on the site. So there's nothing really new here. The other possibility is something like delta y and delta minus y are the same, but they're equal to minus delta x and minus delta minus x. Okay? And that can happen. I mean, if you like, it's symmetry breaking, but the gap phase isn't that, it's important, you'll see. So then, this is called D wave. Yeah?
Is there like some particular reason behind the terminology? Why we're calling it S wave?
S wave because the Cooper-Pair wave function is just symmetrical around even in kx and ky. And just like the S wave function, delta k, which has no k dependence, okay, it's symmetrical. So it has the same symmetry as the S wave gap function. Whereas this one here looks like cos kx minus cos ky, and that has nodes, any way you cut it. If you think about going around the Fermi surface, whatever it looks like in this for this two-dimensional square lattice, it will intersect the lines kx plus or minus ky and vanish along those directions. Okay. So this for sure will have low-lying states for which the gap for excitations is zero. But those low-lying states only happen at, if you like, nodal points on the Fermi surface. or the, yeah, on the Fermi, the two dimensional Fermi surface. Just in those particular points along kx equals ky or minus ky, where these two terms cancel. So the solution for the excitations from the superconducting ground state is otherwise the same. So your excitations are at the square root of epsilon of k minus q squared plus, say, delta d of k squared. But the point is that if you're at the Fermi surface, if epsilon is equal to mu, then this term is zero. And if kx is equal to ky, this term is zero. So the excitation energy is zero at those points on the Fermi surface. So, yeah, let me just draw the Fermi surface for the heck of it. So, say it looks like, what did we say it looked like? It's sort of, yeah, it flattens out like this. Okay, it looks like this. Let's see, something, it's a circle if you're close to zero filling. If you're out here, remember, it goes like that. And so in between, it's in between. And the point is, so that's your Fermi surface if delta is zero. And the thing is that at these points, you're going to have nodes. And so if you call this distance kf from here to here, then I've called this kf over root 2. Probably not a good notation. Okay, so that this distance from here to here is kf. Of course, kf is, depends on angle. But for the nodes. So you have nodes at kf. I guess this works if it's a circle. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It's a superconductor.
So if there's no superconductivity, Fermi surface has some shape. If delta's not zero, which is to say if this is not zero, then you've gapped the Fermi, you have gapped excitations. Except that the gas vanishes along certain directions. So what's your question?
So, it's
like it's not a superconductor? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, I mean, it's a superconductor. So those nodes correspond to the non-superconducting states?
Yeah, it's like normal. No. They're just points. Okay? So they're not that bad. Still acts like a superconductor. Okay? What? Oh, it means something. Yeah. No, it means a lot. I mean, it basically means that when you calculate any property, you don't just integrate over a bunch of states that have the same gap. You integrate over states that have different gaps, which actually vanish at these four points. And so your properties will all be a little bit different. So, but what I said to start with is that, yeah, it's still a superconductor. So, for instance, I mean, how do you know that? Well, you calculate the superfluid density, you calculate the penetration depth, you calculate, which is all other ways of saying, is you calculate that if you set up a supercurrent, what is the density of superconducting electrons, so forth. Normally, you can think that that's pretty well, what, delta, or delta squared, or something like that. In this case, it's not as simple as that, because delta has this angular dependence, so you have to do some kind of funny average. But you still get a non-zero superfluid density, which means if you look at the conductivity, there's a delta function, the little delta function response at zero frequency, and you have the Meissner effect. Okay. Now, if you had actually, there could, yeah.
Are there any funny things that happen?
Yeah, I was just, if what you mean by funny things are what are the differences between the property of a D-wave superconductor and F-wave superconductor, then yeah, I was just going to tell you what they are. But do you mean something more profound like that?
Are there any funny things that happen when, for example, a magnetic field is oriented along that axis?
So in the plane. Films actually work quite that way for just the two-dimensional thing, because then you have to put in the, you have to have a stack of planes and put in some coupling between them and then say what happens, because you'll have vortices. I mean, these materials are all type 2, which means the field penetrates and you get vortices. But maybe something else too. I mean, that is one standard experiment. The anisotropy of something, like, say, the specific heat, as you apply a magnetic field in the plane as a function of angle, to what that does to the excitation, the density of excitation, which is what the heat will depend on. So, all kinds of things happen. So, as it turns out, I think I must have mentioned this, high-TC superconductors are D-wave. Okay? And because they're high-TC superconductors, which is to say, you know, TC is maybe 100 Kelvin, which is maybe 10 or 100 times larger than conventional superconductors, this gap is a big number in some sense. It's big, what does that mean, big? It means it's big compared to experimentally accessible temperatures, because people can easily do experiments at temperatures down to a minute fraction of a Kelvin, and if this is 100 Kelvin, then that can be effectively infinite for some experiments. Okay. So all of this is by way of saying that it makes sense to look at the excitation spectrum if you expand in small distances from this node and see what the excitation spectrum looks like for the low-lying excitations, which start out at zero energy. Okay. And the way to do that is simply to write that K is equal to KF plus, say, K parallel plus K perpendicular, where, so this is KF. And this would be K parallel. And this would be K perpendicular. Is that the way I took it? Actually, I think I took it the other way. Let's take it the other way. Well, okay. Don't ask me why. And the idea is that these things are small. And so then delta of K, you can just write out as 2 delta D0 times cos KF plus, oh, I see. So yeah, that's what I did. I wrote K parallel is equal to K1 K1 over root 2, and K perp is equal to minus K2 over root 2, K2 over root 2. Yeah, like that. Okay, so you could write, so then this is KF plus K1 minus K2 over root 2 minus cos KF plus K1 plus K2 over root 2. And then you expand in powers of and I won't drag you through all the algebra, but this is approximately 4 delta D sine KF over root 2, K2 over root 2. And you can write that. So basically, yeah, that's delta. So basically, this scales with delta, which is presumably small compared to the Fermi energy. You could write this as 2. Say this again? Down here?
No. The very last line you're at, as in just that.
Here? Oh, up here?
Yeah.
How did I get this?
No, I just can't read what you've written.
Oh, 4 delta sine of KF over root 2, and then there's a factor of K2 over root 2. Okay. Yeah, I had this problem. All of my root 2s look like V2s. In my notes, I think it's V2. Okay, so the point is that the dispersion in this direction, which is like a constant, it's like on your Fermi surface, so this is pretty constant, it depends on the gap, which is opening up as you go away from there. And so this V delta is something. And then similarly, if you calculate epsilon of k minus mu, you get, after a little bit of algebra, why do I have a minus sign here? Pretty sure this is a plus sign, unless sine of kf is negative. So let's just say 4t. And this turns out you can satisfy yourself is K1. That's what you would have expected, that if there wasn't any gap and you looked at the energy versus wave vector as you go across the Fermi surface, its slope would be the Fermi velocity. Okay, so that's not surprising. Yes.
I didn't quite follow where you got the K1 and K2 from here.
So basically what I'm saying is that some point in K-space, say this point, I'm going to decompose into a part into KF, which takes me here, plus something in the same direction as KF, plus something which is perpendicular to KF. And so those are KF plus K parallel plus K perp. And I'm going to consider what is the excitation energy in a small region around this node. And so I can expand everything in powers of this over this, component by component. I mean, you have to put in what kx. I mean, this is cos kx minus cos ky. So you have to take kx is this plus this minus, you know, and then ky is kf plus k1 plus k2. That's ky. Okay, this is cos kx minus cos ky for some point here. And then you just work out the expansion. And you get, what do you get? So the excitation spectrum, as a function of K1 and K2 now, the distance is Vf K1 squared plus V delta K2 squared. And so that is an anisotropic Dirac cone. So it's like a cone, but it's squashed. So that it goes up fast along KF radially, and it goes up slowly along the perpendicular direction due to the gap. And that's just because it's much larger than V delta. And that's really true. But nevertheless, it's a cone. So if you like, it's same thing happens in graphene, except in graphene it's a isotropic Dirac cone at the nodal points in the normal state band structure, as you heard from Dimitri the other day. So this is the relationship between energy and wave vector. And you can calculate the density of states. And in the way that you always calculate the density of states, you can calculate the density of states N of E is equal to the sum over all the states E minus E of K. I just wanted to write that down so that, in case I hadn't written it down before, that's how you calculate the density of states. Delta, there's a delta here somewhere. In other words, for every state energy, you count one, and you count them all up, and that gives you the density of states. You just arrange them according to energy. Okay, and what's the answer? The answer is 4e over pi, sorry for the h bars, t over delta. Okay, so that's the density of states for creating an excitation of energy E in any direction around the node. It increases And so that cancels one. Yeah, okay. And I'm not quite sure why I wrote it this way, but you should look at the scales. VF itself goes like T. I guess you can see that here. So actually, there's a T in the denominator, and there's a delta in the denominator. So it's like the slope is some geometrical mean of the Fermi velocity and the Fermi energy in the gap, or T in the gap. Okay. So, and that's what you would expect. Oh, what does this look like? N of E versus E, it actually looks like this. If this is delta, something like that. Sorry, can you see it? It starts off linearly, it peaks around delta, and then starts to go down. It's going to go to a constant, I guess, because out here we expect, well, no, it won't, because this is a tight binding band structure, so it has a, its density of states is not exactly constant. So this is really different because for an S-wave superconductor, you just have a big gap here, nothing below delta. And one other point that I'd like to make is that this was all based on the fact that if you go off in these directions, one of these diagonal directions, you have nodes. And conversely, if you cross the Fermi surface in the x or y, or minus x or minus y directions, you have large gaps. Okay, so at the Fermi surface, there's big gaps along those directions. Those are so-called antinodal. As opposed to antipodal. Yeah. Okay. Where are we going? Question?
Sorry. What happened to the on-site interaction?
To the on-site interaction?
Yeah, the U?
I think we assumed that it was, we had a U. Yeah. Well,
when we did the Fourier transforming, there was no longer a U. Incorporated in the...
I didn't think I had a U when I wrote down... you mean in the Bayer Hamiltonian? Yeah. Yeah, okay, so... So this is all based on, this is all having to do with the pairing Hamiltonian, which if you like, in the context of our self-consistent Hartree-Fock, is the Fager variational Hamiltonian that you have to solve before you can do the actual Hartree-Fock and get your self-consistent results. And the self-consistent results have to do with calculating, using what comes out of this to calculate the free energy, the approximate free energy of the real Hamiltonian minus the appropriate entropy. Okay, so the real Hamiltonian might have a U in it. Okay, and then by assumption it has attractive nearest neighbor things, and the on-site interaction, if it's repulsive, could affect. It won't. It won't actually. In fact, I think for this D-wave thing here, it won't even enter. Into determining the gap, because I think it's like there's a node. The D wave doesn't sample the on-site. The nearest neighbor D wave pairing, I think the average of the on-site interaction for that wave function will probably be zero. Okay. Now, if you had an attractive on-site interaction, then you might not get D wave. You might not get it anyway, but you might. But if you had an attractive on-site interaction, it would tend to enhance this extended S-wave order parameter. Okay. So let me just back up and say one thing then about how one does variational calculations. You assume a form for your probability distribution. Okay. And you can assume that will have some parameters, but in general, you'll make an assumption that will involve some parameters. But you might also have more than one choice for your basic, say, variational Hamiltonian. Okay, it could be like this that's going to have nearest neighbor pairing. It could be you could specialize further to the case where it's D wave, or you could specialize to the case where it's S wave. Okay, and you'll get different self-consistent solutions, and then the rule is you look for the one that has the lowest free energy, and that's the best approximation. So if you have a repulsive on-site interaction, then probably, and an attractive nearest neighbor interaction, then it's a good bet, it's a plausible bet that D-wave will be favored. In other words, have a lower free energy because it isn't so sensitive to the short-range repulsive interaction. This is similar to, I think I've mentioned before perhaps more than once, why helium-3 superfluid is P-wave. It has to do with the Cooper pair wave function allowing them to keep out of the way of each other's core. It has a node. That P-wave angular momentum state has a node for them being on top of each other. So same kind of thing happens here. I should say that for the extended Hubbard model, which has on-site and nearest neighbor, there's a whole phase diagram in terms of the on-site interaction, which can be positive or negative, the nearest neighbor interaction, which in principle can also be positive or negative, and all of those things in units of T, the hopping. But also, there's another parameter in that problem, which is the chemical potential, which says what your density of electrons is. So if you like, if you scale everything with the hopping, you've got a three-dimensional phase diagram in terms of on-site attraction or repulsion, nearest neighbor attraction, repulsion, and chemical potential, which corresponds to filling. Okay? And that phase diagram is complicated, and it has different kinds of ordering, different kinds of superconductivity, and possibly other states that I just don't think of at the moment. Yeah?
Ordinary Hubbard model.
Just on site, TU.
Just TU.
Yeah.
There's still a two-dimensional phase diagram, T over U with the chemical potential.
Yes. Yes.
And is that, and can you draw it as an interesting?
So yeah.
This is all worked out by exact diagonalization. So one knows exactly what that is, independent of any approximations.
I don't know. Let me see. No. No. let's see. So the Hubbard model, you've got four states per site, right? And so the dimensionality of the quantum problem is 2 to the 4th.
Right.
And so you can't do...
So I thought 30 sites was...
You thought?
I thought you could do 30 sites or something.
No, you can do 30... Okay, so actually we made a... One of my grad students, our grad students, made a career out of this, which is doing... two people. Our graduate student, Fei Lin, made a career out of doing quantum Monte Carlo, which is not exact diagonalization, for the Hubbard model. And the systems that he chose were the so-called fullerenes. These are the buckyballs. So the classic buckyball has 60 sites, okay? And you cannot do exact diagonalization on 60 sites. So that's why he did quantum Monte Carlo, okay? And we always wondered, how would we know if he was getting the right answer? So So there, what he was usually working with one electron per site, because that's what you have in those pi orbitals, and then varying U over T from weak coupling to strong coupling. And there were some suggestions about possibility of pairing and stuff like that. Okay. So he did quantum Monte Carlo, and he got some results that were interesting. But we always had this nagging doubt. And so the question was there a similar system that you could do an exact diagonalization for? And there is a fullerene, which I guess is actually may even exist in nature, which is 20 sites. Okay, so it's extremely curved, if you like, and the bonds, the pies don't like it. Okay, but nevertheless, it can exist if only in not for long, maybe. And so Eric Sorensen did exact diagonalizations of the 20-site model, and the dimensionality, so after doing a little bit of symmetry and stuff like that, the dimensionality of his Hilbert space was billions. Okay, and he used Lanczos to calculate ground state energies, okay, which is required some high skill levels and scientific computation, you know, very extraordinary. And so that's how we were able to check. And of course, quantum Monte Carlo, you can kill 20 sites. Not a problem. So yeah, so for that system, yeah. So there's a lot of work on the phase diagram. You know, going from weak coupling calculations are pretty simple. Strong coupling calculations, I'd say, are still not that great. There's methods that can be used to go through intermediate. The guys at Sherbrooke do some, which I don't quite remember off the top of my head. How they work, but yeah. So there's a lot of work on exploring the phase diagram. But I mean, crudely speaking, yeah. So you've got U and mu and the chemical potential, and I guess you know low density. It's a metal. Large U, close to half filling. It's antiferromagnetic, and there's all these strange phases. Yeah, I mean, off the top of my head, I can't draw it for you. I mean, attractive U is simple, relatively speaking. And then there's the question of more than half filled versus less than half filled. And well, let's go on actually, because actually, where are we right now? We're just going on to the cuprate, so we can make discuss this more sensibly if I write down a phase diagram for the cuprate stuff. Okay.
Excuse me. I didn't quite get how do we interpret the diagram of the density of states here?
Starts off linearly because there's vanishing density of states at zero energy, but because the excitation spectrum is a cone in two dimensions, the density of states grows up linearly. And yeah, I would just suggest that you calculate it. I mean, you know, from here to here to here, it's not very far. But that's what you get.
Also, the interpretation.
Say that again?
The interpretation.
The interpretation of linear density of states?
Yeah.
Well, you've got a node. So there's some states at zero energy, but that's only at a point, so the number of states is, you know, zero or one. And then as you go, you know, so these are your states. So here you haven't got very many, and here you've got more, and here you've got more, so forth. And then eventually something else happens. You know, the structure starts to change when you get beyond delta. So basically the length of these circles, which is the E. Okay. So what are the consequences? So let's... Okay, the consequences show up in the temperature dependence of quantities, and what you get is power law temperature dependencies. And so, for instance, the superfluid density NS, which goes like 1 over the penetration depth squared, so that at low temperatures, this goes to the zero temperature penetration depth, and so 1 minus lambda squared of 0 over lambda squared of T. So if you like, that's the normal fluid fraction, the stuff that's not superfluid, goes like e to the minus delta over t for S wave. And it goes like at for D wave. Penetration depth. 1 over lambda squared. Remember, we right back in day one, when we talked about the London equation, and the London equation has the density of superconducting electrons in it, the ones that carry the supercurrent. And from Maxwell's equations, we showed that the field decays into the sample with the London penetration depth. So 1 over lambda squared, we showed, goes like NS. And the point is, so if you plot this, and this is TC, for S wave, this starts off very flat, and then goes like that. This is S wave. And for D wave, it goes very dramatically like that. Okay? I mean, this is all well known now. I can tell you that 20 years or so ago, it wasn't well known. There was a reflexive, instinctive interaction in the community that every superconductor was an S-wave superconductor. And there were there were a number of papers from reputable groups which, you know, said this is clearly follows the S-wave superconducting pattern based on data which was not accurate enough to tell. Okay, and in fact, so this was a huge controversy back in the late 80s, and I guess what we always said was, okay, if you really think it's a S-wave with a gap, take your data, plot it on some kind of a log plot, and come out with a value for the gap to one significant figure that's credible. Okay? Because the measurements were difficult and the samples weren't very good, I think no one was able to do that. And it wasn't until, there were some pretty sensitive microwave measurements. There were hints all over the place that, in fact, this was not a big gap, that this was some power loss, and what they were was the question. There were some very nice microwave measurements which seemed to indicate some kind of a power law reduction in the superfluid density. But people had trouble understanding microwave measurements because they're a little bit complicated to interpret, so they didn't gather a lot of support. So actually, it was my colleague Walter Hardy at UBC and Doug Bond, who was a junior faculty member at the time, that did two things. They first of all started a local industry in making the world's best high TC single crystals so that they were actually good enough so that you could measure meaningful low temperature results. And then they built this, Walter particularly, I guess, built this incredibly sensitive microwave apparatus for measuring the penetration depth, for measuring the essentially when it becomes, as the superconductivity gets weaker, the fields start to go in a little further. That's really what this is telling you. And the microwave measurements can measure essentially the volume which the microwaves penetrate into, the change in the volume as they gradually get let in to the penetration depth of the increasing penetration depth of the sample. They're incredibly precise measurements. And actually, before they did that, they had measured the surface impedance, which is like the imaginary part of the superfluid density. And they had gotten some results which looked distinctly unlike S-wave. But then they measured the penetration depths. And I remember, because he wouldn't tell me for a long time what they saw. And people were talking about T squared and T cubed and all of this kind of stuff. And finally, he admitted it was T. It was this huge linear temperature dependence. And it turned out it corresponded exactly to what this D-wave model would give. Okay, it was like one of these things which was embarrassingly like the simple model. Okay, so, yeah. Yeah, well, so basically, the thing about microwaves is you can measure their, you can create a pure frequency in a microwave cavity if you make it out of good superconductor. You can make an extremely high Q cavity, and you can measure frequencies to ridiculous accuracy, like 10 to 12 decimal places. So basically what you have is you have this cavity where you can think of, for practical purposes, part of the wall of the cavity is the high TC sample. And you change the temperature of the sample without changing anything, without changing the temperature of the cavity. And so then the microwaves, as you warm up the sample, as I was saying, can penetrate further into the sample, like maybe hundredth or a tenth of an angstrom further. Penetration depths are typically a few thousand angstroms for these materials. So they can penetrate these small fractions of an angstrom or more. So basically what you measure is the shift of the resonant frequency of the cavity due to the fact that its volume is changing because the microwaves can penetrate into the superconductor. Okay. And so you can just measure that as a function of temperature showing up some very low temperature. And that translates directly into this superfluid density. Okay. It's a very, very clean measurement. Actually, I should say there's one thing wrong with it, is that although they can measure the change, they can't actually measure lambda of zero, the absolute value of the penetration depth. They can only measure the relative change. And so they actually have to assume a value for lambda zero, okay, in order to correctly plot this. And actually, I should tell you guys this. So Tavi Barnea-Pereg, who is going to teach you your explorations course in condensed matter theory, did a master's thesis in the Bond-Hardy lab. And her project was to measure the absolute value of lambda zero, which they did by implanting magnetic ions into the surface of the superconductor, and then through a magnetic resonance technique, measuring the distribution of local fields that the ions saw as a function of, well, basically the ones at different depths saw different fields. And they were able to translate that into an absolute value for lambda of zero, totally different technique. Okay. So, but anyway, it's a great method, and they understand all that stuff now. Okay, so moving along here. The specific heat CV goes like T squared for this linear density of states. The spin lattice relaxation time, this is NMR, which is a tough measurement of a superconductor, by the way, called 1 over T1, goes like T cubed. And these are all predictions of the simple D-wave theory, which are realized in experiment once it was realized that it was OK to see them. OK, so let's do a little bit more. I mean, this we should spend. We'll spend a lot of time talking about this next time. But so this is the high TC phase diagram. And this X is the density of holes. It's the number of missing electrons per site. And we'll draw this phase diagram out to 0.1, 0.2, 0.3. So, and then this temperature scale here is like 100, 200, 300 in kelvins. So what happens at x equals 0, you have no holes, which means one electron per site. And this is a good insulating antiferromagnet, and which we think of as based on this idea of a Mott insulator. That falls rather quickly, and so this is the antiferromagnetic phase. And there's no superconductivity in there. But the point to this is that adding holes or removing some of those spins rather quickly causes the antiferromagnetic phase to disappear. And then somewhere in here, superconductivity grows up. And this is D wave superconductor. Then there's a whole range in here called the pseudogap region. Which is described in different ways by different people, but the point is that some kind of gap is clearly opening up. You're losing conduction electrons or something in this region. And in fact, you can probably even show that its symmetry is D-wave. But there is no superconductivity until a much lower temperature. And interestingly enough, although superconductivity is being killed as you remove the holes and go to densely packed electrons, the region or the energy scale of this pseudo gap is actually going up and possibly connecting to the AF region. In here, you have something called a strange metal. Which you can just think of as non-Fermi liquid. And then out here, if you like, it's less strange, more Fermi liquid-like. Probably not, but you never know. I mean, I'm sure you'll find people who will tell you that there are actual phase transitions somewhere in here. No. I mean, I don't think anyone can pin down that an actual phase transition. So, I mean, and many people will say these are crossovers, this gap is just, you know, starting to grow up, and eventually something else happens and it becomes superconducting. Okay? So so I'll redraw this for the next lecture and then we can discuss the what goes on in the ITC phase diagram in more detail.
Thank you.